Hi, this is Joe Ziemba, and I'm the host of the podcast When Football Was Football here on the Sports History Network. This podcast is based on stories, events, and characters from my book called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL, which was written shortly after the Cardinals won their last championship in 1947, or so it seems. The reason for this message is twofold. First, to share the great news that the second edition of the book has just been released by McFarland Publishers. And all Sports History Network listeners can now enter a special Sports History Network contest for the opportunity to win one of two free copies of When Football Was Football. We'll be happy to include a personal inscription in each winner's book and then send it out to you with our best wishes. The new book contains about 80 more pages than the original, almost all new archival photos, additions within all chapters based on new research, and an update on the players, coaches, and administrators mentioned in the book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about the early Cardinals, as well as the NFL itself. To enter this free giveaway, go to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Thank you.
Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on a grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, Deft. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Before the forward pass was a staple, football was a game of strategic deception and brute force, and no system did it better than the single wing. It's the offense that made legends out of tailbacks and turned the line of scrimmage into a high-stakes chess match. Tonight, we're going to explore this early offensive strategy and what it does in today's game as well. We're talking about the Wildcat, the spread offense, and more coming up on Pigskin Dispatch. Today we're exploring an offensive scheme that you might only associate with youth football or some trick plays in the Wildcat, but it's a bedrock of American football history and one of the first schemes that really set football apart from other sports and put a little bit of deception into it. But before we get into that, we have to understand a little bit what football was like in the late 19th century. And Timothy B. Brown of Football Archaeology joined us back a few years ago to tell us about how football gained its tradition of getting one player in particular the ball at the snap.
If you think about even rugby today, the guy that we might consider the quarterback, the guy who gets the ball, they're having the scrum and they're using their feet to kick the ball back to that person. Then he picks it up and then he tosses it to somebody else. Well, when football began, they did exactly the same thing because they were playing rugby. And then even as they started, going with the rule of possession and downs and all of that, they still were doing fundamentally the same thing. The center snapped the ball with his foot. And, the ball was laying on its side. He put his foot on top of it or put his foot in front of it and heeled it back or rolled, either way, he rolled the thing back. And so the ball was coming back unpredictably. And so the quarterback, just like the guy in rugby, was kind of squatting behind a foot or two behind the center, and he'd pick the ball up and toss it to somebody else to run with it. So then in football, in the like 1890-ish period, they started snapping with their hands. And initially, there's a great photo of Henry Lewis, who's an All-American center at Harvard. You see him snapping with his hand, but he's got the ball on its side. So when they first started snapping the hand, they were still doing just like they did with the feet. They rolled it on its side back to the quarterback. So the quarterback stayed in more or less the same position as that rugby guy.
By the time that the 20th century rolled around, football was a brutal, smash-mouth game of mass play, and players were literally picking up the ball carrier and dragging him forward. It was so violent that in 1905, 18 players died on the field, prompting Theodore Roosevelt, the president of the United States, to save the game. Then the Rules Committee made sweeping changes, and the most important thing, the legalization of the forward pass in 1906. Enter Glenn Pop Warner, the legendary coach of the Carlisle Indian School. A few years ago, we had biographer of Warner, Jeff Miller, on to tell us a little bit about Warner and the single and double wings that he created.
He developed a single wing, and eventually a single wing becomes the standard formation for every team except, Chicago Bears. Okay, but, for the next 15 years, it's pretty much the go-to formation. And then he also invented the double wing. So the single wing has one wingman out on the side, usually to the right. With a double wing, you have wingmen on both sides. And it's more versatile. It can run to either way very easily, where if you run the single wing, whatever side you put the wing on is usually the side you're going to. With a double wing, you don't know. So that again, was a big deal.
For the single wing, Warner needed a way for his smaller, faster Carlisle players to compete against the massive, bruising teams of the era. Between 1906 and 1908, he invented an entirely new offensive scheme. Warner originally called it the Z formation, or Formation A, and it wasn't until 1928 that Princeton Bill Roper officially coined the term single wing, after observers noted that the backfield alignment resembled a bird's wing. So what made the single wing so revolutionary? First, it featured an unbalanced offensive line, meaning that there were more linemen on one side of the center than the other, and it created a massively strong side, allowing the offense to overwhelm the defense at the point of attack with the double team blocks and trap blocks. But the real magic happened in the backfield. You didn't have a modern quarterback dropping back to pass. Instead, you had four backs that could any one of them could throw the ball. Any one of them can hand off. Any one of them can run. And the star of the show was the tailback, though. The tailback sort of lined up deepest in the backfield to receive a direct snap from the center. And to run this offense successfully, your tailback had to be a triple threat, meaning he could pass, he could run, he could kick the ball effectively. And Pop Warner built the scheme around this, especially a man named Jim Thorpe, who is perhaps the greatest athlete of all time. And Carlisle, using him at tailback, began pulling off massive upsets, like a stunning 27-6 victory over the mighty Army team in 1912. The tremendous success of the single wing wasn't just about the raw power. It was built on the deception and misdirection that the players created by their actions.
In the early 19-teens, when, the Notre Dame box was getting big and there was a rule change regarding who could run with the ball, the first guy receiving the snap from center could now run with the ball, and so they started snapping back to the fullback or halfback in the backfield, and so the whole single wing offense and the Carlisle formation and all that kind of stuff was coming into play.
So there were a lot of times at this point where the quarterback never even touched the ball, and a lot of times he would stay in the same position. Now, sometimes you just move a position or two, and there's other times he'd stay in and get the ball. It's a lot more about of a fake, and or just a lot of it to change them up a little bit. Then the single wing allowed any of the four backs to run, pass, block, and it birthed the spinner series where the fullback would receive the snap, spin 360 degrees, and fake handoffs to the tailback or wingback crossing in front of him, leaving the defense completely blind and really misconceived on who was really actually getting the ball. But it also featured buck lateral series where the fullback would fake a plunge into the line, drawing in the linebackers, or what was not the other linebacker, but the center of the line, and then fake the plunge and toss quick lateral to the quarterback or the wingback who would run around the end. There was so much that you could do, but just handing off and faking the handoffs and a lot of misdirection in the backfield was really the main success of the single wing offense. But the one problem was, like we alluded to earlier, you sort of knew where it was going to. It was usually going to that power side where you had the wing too. And defenses had to contend with it, and they did. And that's why what brought on the double wing of Pop Warner just a few years later. But as the single wing spread, incredible innovators put their own genius spin on it. You know, General Bob Nayland at Tennessee used the balanced line, introduced the side saddle quarterback, which the quarterback stood perpendicular to the line of scrimmage to hide the ball and execute lightning fast fakes and even line up maybe not even under center. And Fritz Kreisler at Michigan added pre-snap shifts in motion to completely scramble defense alignments. Jock Sutherland at Pitt created the Sutherland single wing, bringing the wing back into the backfield to create a dominant weak side running attack. And even Pop Warner himself evolved the scheme, creating that double wing by splitting out the second wing back to balance the attack. And for nearly 40 years, the single wing was the undisputed king of football, producing legends like Red Grange, Bronco Nagurski, and Heisman winner Tom Harmon. But all the great empires fall, even the single wing offense. For the single wing, the beginning of the end arrived in 1940. The football itself had slowly evolved from a round, melon-like shape into a streamlined, prolate spheroid, making it much easier to throw tight spirals. And enter Clark Shaughnessy. Shaughnessy modernized the T formation, which placed the quarterback directly under center. And in 1940, Shaughnessy helped the Chicago Bears use the T formation with, along with George Halas, to obliterate the Washington Redskins by a score of 73-0 in the NFL championship game. Just weeks later, his Stanford Indians used the same offense to shock Nebraska in the 1941 Rose Bowl game. Yes, the T formation was the undoing of the single wing as the dominant offense, but it didn't make the single wing totally disappear. The failure of the single wing wasn't that it stopped working, but it was simply it was outpaced by the specialization. The new T formation allowed the quarterback to drop back quickly and survey the whole field and hit receivers in stride. And coaches found the single wing's direct snaps and complex backfield blocking too slow to a modern passing game. Now, by the 1950s, the T formation had totally taken over, and a few stubborn holdouts remained: UCLA, Tennessee, and Princeton. With Princeton running the single wing all the way to the until 1969, but the era of the triple threat tailback had ended. But did the single wing truly fail? As legendary Denison coach Keith Piper said, there is no way to improve on football beyond the unbalanced single wing. It just went out of style. In truth, the ghost of Pop Warner's masterpiece is still on the field in every single weekend. The pulling guards, the trap blocking, the play action passes that dominate on Sundays were all born in the single wing offense. And when you see a modern offense run a wildcat formation, you know, that's when in the NFL you see the quarterback, starting quarterback go over as a wideout and one of the tailbacks or halfbacks is taking a direct snap. Well, that is a form of the single wing. Now, you're watching the exact items that Jim Thorpe ran over a century ago. The single wing wasn't just a formation, it was a crucible that forged modern football. We thank you for joining in and learning a little bit about this single wing offense. We're going to get into some more of these offensive developments and the evolution of the football game here in the coming weeks here on Pigskin Dispatch. And don't make sure you check our regularly scheduled programming, including we're going to have 32 straight days of Ed Cleese and I talking about the draft history. Not going to be doing mock drafts. We're talking draft history. 32 straight days starting on March 22nd, which is 32 days before the draft. And we're going to talk about position selection number 32 and the history of that all the way to number one on draft day. Till next time, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network, and we're able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear. starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.